Hey! One more step and you're dead. Try to leave us and you're dead. Just stay where you are and you're dead.
Off by a horde of mutants, we welcome longtime listener and friend of the show, Sean Byron, to sit in as we talk three post-apocalyptic flicks. First, a young boy must traverse the barren wasteland alongside his telepathic canine companion in 1976's A Boy and His Dog, directed by L.Q. Jones. Next, the classic tale of Boy Meets Girl is interrupted by an inevitable nuclear strike and the end of the world set to a score by Tangerine Dream in the bleak Miracle Mile from 1988. Finally, a dystopian New York and more mutants, roller skates, and mayhem as we talk 1990 The Bronx Warriors featuring Fred the Hammer Williamson and, in his penultimate role, Vic Morrow.
Oh man, that better not have just been the fucking earthquake. If I went and fried my brain over an earthquake, I'd... Sheriff!
This is Junk Food Dinner. This is the show where we scour the internet and the video stores, the one video store that's left, and other places, cable TV perhaps. This is a podcast where I never had to memorize this opening spiel that Kevin always does. I'm Parker. I'm in California. I'm joined by a friend of the show, Sean Byron, also in California, and co-host of Pool Party Radio, Jason Razor Babes Frizzbabe, as Kevin is in Boston, Massachusetts, and Mark was murdered and set on fire while celebrating his birthday.
Jesus.
I know.
Did that all happen?
Yes, it's true.
Yeah.
This
Very
week,
sad.
It is tremendously sad. It was his birthday, after all. This week, in honor of the end of the world, which is coming in a couple of weeks, we are doing three movies about the apocalypse or the post-apocalypse. We will be talking about Miracle Mile from 1988, The Bronx Warriors from a year that is not 1988, and A Boy and His Dog from 1974, I believe. But before we get to that, how are yous fellows doing?
Doing pretty good over here. This is Sean Byron, first time on the show. I've been listening for quite a while. Pretty excited to be on Junk Pool Dinner Party tonight. should be a fun experience.
It's a big mashup.
Yeah, this is how podcast mashups work.
Yeah. This isn't a new episode of anything. We're just taking an old episode of Pool Party and an old episode of Junk Food Dinner, squishing them together, and then adding a new audio track, which is Sean Byron.
You guys have been getting ready for the holiday season at all?
No.
Watching any of those Die Hards or those Gremlins or Silent Night, Deadly Nights?
I've been dropping the ball, actually. At this point, I probably should have been watching Die Hard. Well, at least Die Hard and Die Hard 2 back to back. But I have not. Damn, I feel like a chump now. I've been trying to dodge Christmas so much that I've been missing out on the best part. What about yous, dudes?
It's kind of weird. I mean, I feel like in October, I have a lot of motivation to watch all these Halloween-themed movies. And then by the time Christmas rolls around, there are a number of good Christmas movies that I genuinely like, you know, like Die Hard and Gremlins, but I never get around to them. But I was excited this week to pick up some tickets to go see a couple Christmas-themed horror movies theatrically. Here in L.A., Gremlins is playing at the Chinese Theater, and the New Beverly is doing Black Christmas and Silent Night, Deadly Night 2, so looking forward to those.
That sounds pretty good. I recently watched Gremlins for the first time in a long time over Halloween, and I realized, and I went on a huge rant about this on the Facebook, but at the end, all those gremlins are walking around in snow, and snow is water.
And yeah, that's a good point.
So that movie is ruined for me now.
Wait, the gremlins or the whatever the furry things are?
The Mogwais.
Gizmos.
The Mogwais?
Well, they both get fucked up by water.
The Mogwais, yeah, the indie bands. I totally forgot that name. Yeah. Oh, they both get fucked up in water.
Yeah.
So I haven't seen the movie in eons, too.
So these guys, when they're walking around in snow the whole time, the moment a drop of snow melted and turned into water, they should have multiplied again.
But, yeah, yeah, likely. Yeah.
Well, I mean, the rest of the movie was extremely logical and... Yeah, that's the only flaw in Gremlins, right?
I agree. The rest of it makes perfect sense.
Airtight.
That a magical old Asian man would give a magical troll to a family. That happens every day in America.
It's way more logically sound than Prometheus. I'm fairly certain of that.
That's true. But yeah, I was also taken aback at the charming 80s racism of that guy who just owns a magic shop for some reason.
Yeah. It always reminds me of that Simpsons with the Krusty doll. And Homer goes to pick up the Krusty doll in the basically the same shop. Yeah. It's,
with the cursed Froyogurt.
Yeah. The Froyogurt comes with sodium benzoate. Long pause. That's bad.
And why such a small town had a Chinatown is beyond me.
For plot development to keep going.
That's it. You've convinced me I'm no longer going to see Gremlins this week.
I'm doing my part.
It'll be awesome. It'll be awesome. Like any of those movies on the big screen is, you know, you don't have to think all that much about how the plot's being pushed along. Even with Prometheus, I was like, oh, it's, I'm still into it.
I mean, it was. I thought Prometheus was very pretty to look at.
Yeah.
If nothing else. And you just turn your brain off and you can enjoy at least the visuals.
Oh, yeah.
That's true. That's how I feel about all Charlize Theron movies.
That's how, yeah, that's how I feel about Bronx Warriors, since we're going to be talking about that later. But now you mention it, just kind of have to shut it off and watch.
Well, without further ado, this cat. All right, so without further ado, I say we get into a little bit of this nerd news. Oh, it broke. This is...
From the global resources of Junk Food Dinner Worldwide, it's time for Nerd News.
First up on Nerd News, Martin Sheen is returning as Uncle Ben in The Amazing Spider-Man 2. Now, I actually like the reboot of this series, of the Spider-Man series, but I picked out this story specifically for Parker. Parker, what do you think of this story? Since it's the origin story of Peter Parker as Spider-Man, and Uncle Ben died in the first movie. What do you think of this?
I'm shocked about this. I assume that he'll be back in zombie form or something. I don't know. Yeah, this is... I don't know. I like this movie a lot, but I think you've kind of worn out Martin Sheen's welcome, as he's dead now. That's like one of the defining characteristics his character has, is that he's dead.
He's shot in the face. That's right. That's what makes Spider-Man Spider-Man. He sees his uncle get shot right between the eyes. It's not that specific, but yeah.
So I'm one of those people that that was basically boycotting this new Spider-Man movie, thinking that it was too soon for another reboot. But I'm starting to hear now from people that it was actually worth watching. Is that in fact true?
And for me, it was. I was like a webhead growing up. That was the comic I identified with. I enjoyed, and yeah, I was really cautious about it too. I basically went in just having been a fan, and being so disappointed with Spider-Man 3, I was like, well, maybe a reboot's kind of what I need to get the bad taste out of my mouth. And, yeah, I mean, it takes a little bit more hold with, I guess, a mix between the Ultimate series and the original Spider-Man origin story, like having the Lizard be, like, the first main villain and all that kind of stuff. But, yeah, this is kind of... It's a weird sort of bonkers thing. I'm sure he's going to show up like in a dream sequence or something. Because that's what they're attesting to.
Yeah. But I would hope that that's all there is.
But yeah, did you ever get a chance to see it, Sean? Or
No, I haven't gotten around to it yet. But I keep hearing good things, so I probably will eventually. Although I have to admit, I was one of the few people in the world to be underwhelmed by the Avengers movie.
Did you see Did you see the ones leading up to it, like the Thors and everybody?
Yeah, and I enjoyed most of those. I actually really enjoyed the newer Hulk reboot. I thought that was very good, and Captain America I thought was pretty decent. But I don't know, maybe the expectations were too high. I had heard so much hype going into the Avengers that I think I may have oversold myself on it, and then I should probably revisit it.
Yeah, I've watched it a good many times. It's good. I think it gets less good the more not the more I watch it, but now that I'm watching it on DVD rather than the big screen, because it's mostly just 2.5 hours of fighting, dudes fighting, and little else. And that doesn't translate as well on TV.
Yeah. My first experience with it was at home, so I may have just missed that that big screen experience.
That's possible. But yeah, this Spider-Man, it's really good. It's a lot more dramatic than those Avengers. It's a real story about real people. And I was opposed to it as well for the same reasons you were, but then I saw it because Seth Kuzer told me to. And he was completely right. It's very good. And I will dare say that it's better than any of those Sam Raimi movies.
That's a bold statement.
How dare you?
1.5 of those are good.
Yeah. Yeah, well, it's better than that good one. Yeah, the first piece of nerd news I have is that Kevin Smith is apparently ditching his first post-retirement movie entitled Hit Somebody, a movie about hockey, which is something that America's been clamoring for lately ever since that Stifler movie about hockey went straight to Netflix. I'm sure everybody's waiting for the big follow-up hockey movie, but he's ditching that apparently. Or at least doing something else with it. It might be a 6-hour movie miniseries on television, which is something that people are probably even more clamoring for. But he'll also be doing Clerks 3 as his second post-retirement production. This is very sad, I feel, for Kevin Smith. He you know, he says that he's going to retire, and then he goes out saying he's going to make more movies. I don't know what he's up to. But I think, you know, Red State, he went on this big thing about, he said, oh, we're going to ditch the movie studios and we're going to go out and do this ourselves and it's going to be independent. We're just going to shop it around and take it from city to city like the olden days. And I think that was just him saving face, you know, on account of Red State was terrible and I don't think anybody wanted to put it out, especially after the fact that, you know, the last 5 of his movies have sucked tremendously. And I think this is the only thing that he could do that will actually make it to theaters, is something called Clerks 3.
I'm kind of confused why he just doesn't do a restance on Clerks the Animated Series. And I think that's what everybody wants to see, and instead he's like, oh, I'll just give you the movie instead. That's what you're asking for, right?
Yeah.
It seems way off base.
I would much rather see a cartoon than this real-life one.
Yeah, that cartoon was great, and it's still hilarious. I have the DVDs, and if you pop them in, they are as funny now as they were then. Yeah, obviously the quality of his films has done nothing but decline in the past 10 years. Although I think if this is what it takes to get him away from the internet, then maybe it's not such a bad thing. distract that guy from Twitter for 5 minutes, and I'll be happy.
That's understandable, and yeah, I don't understand how he'll. Although maybe I shouldn't make this joke, as it's the pot calling the kettle black, but I don't know how he'll have time to make this movie when he's got 80,000 podcasts to do a week.
Yeah, that's... You're doing a mashup podcast now. I think you should probably back off that accusation.
Well, he does more podcasts than me.
So it's ridiculous. Yeah,
I still feel justified. As I feel, I do way too many podcasts, and he does 8 times more than I do.
When you do when you start doing a podcast, it's just you and your dog, Kepi. Then it's going to be spot on. It'll be you and Kevin Smith going head to head with who has the most podcasts.
I see that you have found found the fact that I registered the domain name Kepcast recently.
Yeah, it's disturbing, but. I'm not saying I wouldn't listen. It's probably going to be something I'll subscribe to. Yeah.
Well, I appreciate that.
All right. The first piece of nerd news that I have is Jackie Chan has set 2 Guinness World Records. This is from twitchfilm.com. says, today Chan was officially awarded most stunts performed by a living actor and most credits in one movie while attending the opening of the Jackie Chan Film Gallery in Shanghai. Apparently this is related to his new film Chinese Zodiac, in which he holds 15 credits to his name, including writer, director, lead actor, producer, executive producer, cinematographer, art director, unit production manager, I don't even know what that is, catering coordinator, stunt coordinator, gaffer, composer, theme tune vocalist, I don't want to hear that, props and stuntman. So that's something, that's pretty impressive. Although I'm not so sure I would want to eat any food that Jackie Chan has personally catered.
Yeah. Well, is it catering, or did it say catering coordinator or whatever?
Yeah.
Because I think that just means calling the catering company and telling them to come.
So he called the Chinese equivalent of Pizza Hut, and they delivered pizzas.
Yeah. I think it's, that's how you get that credit. That's an easy one.
These Guinness World Records always crack me up because it seems to me that they are just awarding awards to people to gain publicity for themselves and their own little book that they try to sell more than anything else, you know. And I love Jackie Chan, and I think he deserves, you know, tons of credit for everything he's done. But most credits in one movie, like, is that really an award that we need?
No. Yeah, I really liked Guinness back when it was, like, people with weird fingernails and, like, the guy who ate the most hair, or, like, the guy who ate an airplane and those fat twins on the motorcycles. But, yeah, now it's just, like, oh, here's, you know, Jackie Chan, he did the most stuff in a movie, and here's Adam Carolla with the most downloaded podcast. Like, it seems like now that they're doing records for, like, famous people that will get on the news, it's like it's lost something.
Yeah, and a lot of these are so difficult to even validate. I'm sure that there's somebody out there who made a shot-on-video horror movie in the 80s that had more than 15 credits.
That's what I was thinking. I mean, the way that you're rattling off, like, every involvement he had with that movie just sounds like a lot of the stuff that's been shown on cable television. Well, it used to be cable television. It'd always be like one dude, and he'd be next to every single job and assignment during the end of whatever shoot it was. Sometimes as a joke, just like, yeah, I did everything. They even made all the sandwiches. Derp.
Yeah, Beelzebub probably does all that stuff.
Yeah.
And he also has the extra credit of rapist.
Next up?
The next thing we have is Alex Winter, star of Bill and Ted and Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey, and Freaked, director of Freaked, amazing all-around dude. He was on one of our episodes of this show a long time ago, number 16, I think. The trailer for his documentary about Napster is out. This is a movie that he was talking about doing. I think it was like in the very early stages when he was on the show all those years ago. And now it's finally coming to fruition. This is something that I guess he put The Gate on hold, or is doing well. His remake of The Gate is on hold, one of the two. And yeah, so this sounds exciting. Napster more or less changed the entire world, so I'm excited to see this movie.
Yeah, actually, I saw that trailer in that news article that you posted. It looks amazing. I was really impressed with, you know, the footage that they got, the interviews that they had, and how polished it looked. So I'm really looking forward to this. I'm sure that you guys grew up, you know, using Napster as well, and it was an interesting time in the development of internet history, I think.
Yeah, I remember taking about 6 hours to download an Eminem song once.
I think my favorite memory from back in those days is downloading entire albums of songs credited to Weird Al Yankovic that were not actually his work.
Yeah, it was all like crappy stuff from like morning radio stations, like shows from across the U.S.
Yeah, they're all Bob and Tom tracks. That's the sad truth of it.
Yeah. It was like all this horrible stuff that like Weird Al would never do. Like all, like, yeah, all these songs about like farts and stuff. Weird Al's above that. He's not doing no songs about farts.
Yeah, I was duped into like mistaking the file name for something, or not even that, but it'd be like the song I was looking for, like you were doing with those Weird Al albums, and it would just be something entirely different. Like, I was trying to download, I think it was Fishbone. This was when I was real, real balls deep into a ska phase that I was in. And it was not Fishbone at all. It was something ridiculous.
It was Fish, the band, the jam band.
Yeah, that's what I misread. It was P-H-I-S-H Bone. And it was just 40-minute long track of nothing, just twanging around drum beats.
How did we live back then?
I don't know, man.
It was rough.
It took all day, like you mentioned. It was just forever to download one song, let alone entire albums of stuff.
Oh,
I'm
yeah.
I'm sure someday when we all have grandkids, we're going to be telling them, you know, back in my day, it took 6 hours to download a track, and you weren't even sure if it was the right one, and it was snowing both ways, and yada, yada, yada.
Yeah.
And if the other person wasn't there, you were screwed. The peer-to-peer connection was split.
And even when you did get it, the audio quality was middling at best. Also, MP3s used to be like 7 megabytes each. We could barely fit 4 of them on our computers.
That's right. We didn't listen to them anywhere else. We had to compress them onto a CD. CDs!
Just like that bad guy did from Hellraiser 3.
Yeah. Yeah.
Dark days.
Dark Knight Rises, but not The Master, when AFI makes their top 10 of 2012. There's a list of what AFI considers to be movies of this year. Includes Argo, Beasts of the Southern Wild, Django Unchained, which hasn't actually been theatrically released yet, but it's had some screenings, Moonrise Kingdom, and so on. And The Dark Knight Rises is on this list of 10. I was kind of stunned by this, actually. You guys saw Dark Knight Rises, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, and would you consider it to be, like, one of the movies of the year?
No.
Certainly, if you measure it in terms of hype, but nothing else.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know exactly why it was chosen, unless it's purely based on, like, the theater shooting. Like, they have to give recognition for that. In some respect, but as far as like movie quality goes, I don't know. Like, I kind of thought the predecessor was better.
Yeah, most everything is better.
Did either of you guys see The Master?
No,
I didn't.
I saw it. It's a weird film. I mean, it's pretty bizarre. But it does feel like the type of film that AFI would love in particular. It's because it's so challenging. I wasn't crazy about it, but I kind of appreciated what he was going for. But yeah, Dark Knight Rises, I feel like, is just a lesser version of the original Dark Knight. So
I agree. I think that Mark Fredo actually saw The Master, and he says that he hates it so much, you know, that it's one of the worst movies. And, you know, the director had this to say afterwards.
I know it was you, Fredo. You broke my heart.
All right. We're very good at drawing here today. I hated this Batman movie. Batman got a spoiler alert. Although I think I've spoiled this about 80 times on Junk Food Dinner already. But Batman gets his back broken so bad that pieces of it pop out of his skin. And he fixes it by doing push-ups for a couple of weeks. That's something that really happens in that movie. So it's awful. That is awful.
Don't forget, hanging by his arms and chest, that's medical professionals in that dungeon there where he's staying.
Yeah.
And they know best. All you have to do if you have a broken back, anyone who's paralyzed from broken back, they just need to hang by their arms and chest like a ragdoll, and they'll get it pretty soon enough. They'll get better.
Yeah. Bane's all, hey, Batman, now that I've broken your back, I'm not going to kill you. I'm just going to put you in this hole that is easy to get out of if you've been trained by the League of Shadows like we have.
Yeah. Yeah, that's absolutely right. I totally forgot about that development in his character. It's like, oh, I can jump like a ninja. I could just run up these walls if I wanted.
Yeah.
Plus, I'm a genius, so I could, you know, defeat the physics of this pretty easily anyway.
Yeah, Bane's all like, how can I get rid of this guy who, his whole life, like, he's made a career out of, like, scaling the skyscrapers of Gotham, the highest skyscrapers in the world. I know, I'll put him in a hole. I mean, the only way you can get out is, like, to scale it. Yeah, that's my plan there.
Well, and together with a bunch of other prisoners that, you know, are obviously going to try and help them out at some point.
Yeah, put them in there with other prisoners who also want to escape.
Cool. So next up on Nerd News, Johnny Depp stabs Terry Gilliam in the back over Don Quixote. Disney has closed a deal for an untitled pitch to be written by Jeff Morris and Steve Pink of Hot Tub Time Machine. The project is best described as a modern reimagining of Don Quixote. Depp has long been intrigued with that character and at one time was attached to the Quixote film that Terry Gilliam tried to make. Did you guys ever see Lost in La Mancha?
Yeah, I was about to ask if any of you guys did. That's a documentary about Depp and Gilliam trying to actually film it, correct? And they just keep running into potholes during filming?
Yeah, that's right. It was a very good documentary. And it showed that struggle that they had, that a million things went wrong when they were trying to film. Their lead actor broke his hip during filming and then couldn't ride a horse anymore. And so they tried to work around that. And then all these sets that they built got hit by some crazy hurricane and were all destroyed. And they tried to work through that. And then their financiers fell through and just everything fell apart, as tends to happen on Terry Gilliam production. But what I thought was interesting is you could see throughout that documentary how close the two of them were and how willing Johnny Depp was to stick with Gilliam throughout all those troubles. So this was a big surprise to me, and I was greatly looking forward to Terry Gilliam eventually making that Don Quixote film. It seems now that it's not going to happen.
Yeah, it sounds like Depp's actually striking out his own here. But that is unusual. He is very willing to help Gilliam out with stuff, at least from the Imaginarium of Dr. Parnassus. After Ledger died, he ended up being one of the alternate roles. Like, there was these dream scenes in that movie that Ledger was supposed to play. And because he died and couldn't do these green screen set scenes, they brought in Depp and I think Jude Law and somebody else. I forget who. But it was three dudes who look kind of roguish, like what Ledger did in the movie, and Depp was one of them.
Yeah, so just to come in, the third might have been Colin Farrell, if I remember right. Maybe
I think you're right, because they all had I remember they all had jet black hair and ponytails or something.
I was actually really impressed with how they handled that on Imaginarium. I thought that was a clever solution to a really unfortunate turn of events for them. Yeah, I mean, that turned out to be a decently watchable film, all things considered. Unlike, some of the other stuff Gilliam's been doing lately. But yeah, this is strange news, in my opinion. Do you have any thoughts on Terry Gilliam, Parker?
I don't know much about him. He was in Monty Python, right?
Yeah, certainly you've seen Brazil, haven't you?
No, I think I've only seen Fear and Loathing, which I love. I love that to death, so.
Time Bandits? Have you seen Time Bandits?
Yeah, when I was a small British child, I saw Time Bandits.
Okay. What about The Adventures of Baron Munchausen? You ever see that one?
No.
12 Monkeys?
No.
I sense a theme show coming up.
We might... well, spoiler alert. I think we're doing a time travel movie theme show in a couple of weeks, so maybe we'll do 12 Monkeys.
Or Time Bandits.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Or maybe if we do a monkey theme show, we can do 12 Monkeys. That would be pretty good. But about this Don Quixote, you know what they say about me, right, Frisbee? That I'm a real Don Quixote of Donkey Dookie?
I've heard that before. You're the real Don Quixote of Donkey Dookie. You got that right.
Syphil and Ollie references. All right, so let's get into some DVDs. The first DVD I have is the first season of Girls on DVD and Blu-ray. This is a show that I've talked quite a bit about loving. I know a lot of people are hating Lena Dunham right now on account of she got a huge book deal for all the book money left in the world, despite being a very young, it's this book. She got $3.6 million or something to write a book of advice for people, despite the fact that she's in her mid-20s, and I guess this offends a lot of people, but she's on a great TV show, so I think more power to her. If she can give advice to people to be on one of the best TV shows, then that's advice worth giving. I love this show, and I will probably buy this on Tuesday. even though people make fun of me for it.
I still haven't seen one episode of the show, but I keep hearing about how good it is. Not just from you, which would be like the most likely thing, since I think you're like one of the few people I actually speak to on a weekly basis. But yeah, it's something I see like people just fawning over all the time. Have you seen any of these, Sean? Any of girls?
I've not seen this, and I have no opinion on it.
I think it's good. To tie it into the culture of junk food dinner, Mike from Phantasm 2 is on it. So,
oh, nice.
That's how it becomes culty. That's what justifies me talking about it right now. What is your first DVD, Sean?
Let's see. I've got, first up, I've got Godfrey Reggio's Nonverbal Cutsy Trilogy on Criterion DVD and Blu-ray, December 11th. So let's see what the copy here says. A singular artist and activist, Godfrey Reggio is best known for the galvanizing films of the Cutsy Trilogy. So these are Koyaanis Kotsi, Paua Kotsi, and I can't even pronounce the last one, but these are three nonverbal documentaries. Have you seen any of these? Am I the only one that's into these? These are they're pretty interesting films. It's kind of like if you took a National Geographic nature / cultural documentary and then removed all the dialogue and put Philip Glass music on top of it. So it's,
oh yeah, I remember these. Yeah, it's like a lot of it's fast motion, and well, some of it's fast motion. Like they'll do traffic views of traffic scenes.
Exactly. Then,
okay.
Yeah, it's a lot of like time lapse photography, and it's all shot in 70mm. They're really beautiful films. I don't feel like they get enough attention. Maybe because it's kind of a difficult sit. To sit for 2 hours without dialogue, but I think they're really wonderful, wonderful movies.
They're really stunning to look at. But I remember I was drinking coffee when I was watching. What's the first one called?
Koyaanisqatsi.
That's right. I was trying to watch that, and because it was just like fast moving traffic with this Philip Glass music and cuts of people like staring at TVs. I got a real bad anxiety attack. It's like, why aren't they doing anything? They're not talking. I knew what I was getting into, but I still, yeah, freaked out. It's good, though. It looks amazing. I'm sure this will be a really cool print of it, too. Or the entire series, you said. There's three films, correct?
Yeah, it's all three. On Blu-ray from Criterion, so you know it's probably going to be pretty good.
I know nothing about this.
I think you would hate it, Parker. But I'm sure that there's somebody else out there in junk food dinner land that is into this type of thing. So heads up, it's coming to Criterion.
That was another thing that Simpsons actually referenced. They did a something based on that too. I forget what it was though.
I think they've done everything at this point.
Yeah, they've run out of the references.
Yeah.
What is it? Have they done
They did
good.
The Onion last night.
They did, yeah. Onion AV Club, too. It was pretty snarky. I liked it.
Yeah.
I hear there was also a Screeching Weasel song in that episode last night, which I think they're a good band.
Yeah, it should. I don't know, but there was, yeah, definitely some different tracks in there, so very likely. Next up on the DVDs this week is The Bourne Legacy. This was kind of like an under the radar. Well, I mean, it got a lot of publicity, but it didn't really do well against other summer films, starring Jeremy Renner and Rachel Weisz. This was supposed to be kind of a bit of a buffer for the Bourne series, which the Jason Bourne trilogy seems just about over, and only features Jason Bourne and Matt Damon by picture in the film, focuses on Jeremy Renner as part of this, as part of the government program that manufactured Jason Bourne. So what that amounts to is basically like barely an hour and a half long film of Jeremy Renner running away from the government. It's that's a lot of the film, just running and jumping and sliding down very narrow alleyways. If you saw that trailer, then you've probably seen the bulk of the movie. So that's all that happens.
Sounds like a metaphor for Mitt Romney's tax practices, eh? Running and jumping to get away.
Running and jumping, yeah.
That's
beating up cops.
That's topical, yeah. That's still going on, right, Mitt Romney?
It's a smart joke.
Yeah.
The movie also features Edward Norton, and just cuts to him drinking coffee in an office and getting stressed out. Did you guys ever see this film?
No, I didn't see this one, but I did like Jeremy Renner quite a bit in The Hurt Locker.
Yeah, I like that guy, even though I think I've only seen him in like two things, none of which being The Hurt Locker, although I want to see that. But yeah, I've never seen any of these Bournes. I guess I should. I think I like Matt Damon sometimes. So I should probably get in on these one day.
Yes, same here. I've never seen any of the Bourne Identity films. I think it's interesting that Jeremy Renner, he's been around for a long time, but I feel like he was unnoticed up until recently, and I believe he's already in his 40s, so it's a little bit unusual for an actor to go that long without being thrust into the limelight like he has been.
Yeah, well, I think he had the problem of the fact that he was in National Lampoon's Senior Trip, and I think that really hurt his career for a very long time.
Ouch. Yeah, I feel guilty for saying this, but I had no idea that he was doing stuff. I didn't know who he was until The Avengers. And he played Hawkeye, the least favorite Avenger.
Yeah, the least good Avenger.
But you made him likable. Like, I used to play as Hawkeye in the old Avengers arcade cabinet game. Or no, it wasn't that. It was a Spider-Man and Friends. He just shows up and shoots arrows. So that was a character I'd play with. Some other kid was playing as Spider-Man. Not a really interesting story, but it happened a lot.
Yeah, he was also in one of the Avengers arcade games where it was him and Vision and Captain America. And man, if you didn't, like, if your friend got to Captain America before you, you were going to have a bad time because Hawkeye and Vision were stupid.
Yeah, that's your punishment for being late to the arcade.
Yeah, you get to be Vision. The next thing I have is the film Night Claws. This is a movie I've been looking forward to for a long time. It's directed by David Pryor, who did Killer Workout and a bunch of other things. Deadly Prey, I believe. He's great. And he did this movie, which is about killer Bigfoots. It says a bloodthirsty Bigfoot, which kills without warning, is on a rampage near a small town. This is not your ordinary Bigfoot. This ain't your grandpappy's Bigfoot. This creature is lightning fast, incredibly strong, and seems to thrive on not just killing, but tearing people apart as well. That seems like my ordinary Bigfoot, to be honest. A lot of movies about Bigfoot, that's exactly how he does. A strong, beautiful, and sometimes mysterious woman. I don't know how you can sometimes be mysterious. You're either mysterious or you're not.
She has mysterious days.
Yeah. She shows up claiming to represent the federal government and pushes the local sheriff into hunting down the creature, but they are not alone in their hunt. Multiple groups of hunters all seek out the famed prize. And the lines become seriously blurred between the hunter and the hunted. And that sentence always gets me excited for movies. This stars Reb Brown, who you may know from Space Mutiny, The Howling 2, all the most terrible stuff. The Captain America movies before the real Captain America, and also Frank Stallone. Like I said, I'm very excited for this movie. I think it's going to be just terrible and just great. And I think I talked those other guys, Kevin and Mark, into doing an entire Bigfoot theme show in support of just this one movie. So, very excited I am.
Nice. Yeah, David Pryor and Bigfoot alone, I mean, that's all it takes for me. I'm sold on that. I really love Deadly Prey, and Killer Workout is a lot of fun too, so this should be nothing but fun.
How you feel about Big Feetsman, Frisbee?
It sounds fun, but I'm kind of harping on the topic when you said this isn't Granddaddy's Bigfoot, and you're reminiscing, like, I guess that's always been Bigfoot, but how upset would it make you feel if I mentioned that if that's one of the taglines that they're trying to sell it on, like the sitting in your granddaddy's Bigfoot, they're referring to Harry from Harry and Henderson's, which was in the 80s, which would be us, meaning we're the grandpas.
This is a terrible twist ending.
We were the grandpas the whole time.
Oh, no. He's upset about being the grandpas, you see.
Bruce Willis was the grandpa. He was always the grandpa.
Oh, well, now I'm depressed about being the grandpas. And yeah, I watched that movie recently, and yeah, he was a very nice Bigfoot.
He was the nicest Bigfoot. And yeah, I mean, and it's not to say that totally died out. Well, actually, I was going to use the Slim Jim commercials as an example of how like Bigfoots aren't ridiculously violent, but that one has a pretty short temper. So.
That's true. He gets mad a lot. I mean, those guys are just playing tricks on him. He goes nuts. Yeah, I guess there are a lot of nice Bigfeets out there. But Little Bigfoot is also a very nice Bigfoot. But
the animated Brontosaurus?
No, there's, I think it's called Little Bigfoot. They talk about it on the Kissing Contest show, or they have before. It's like some terrible children's movie about some kids who find a tiny Bigfoot, and they keep him as a slave or something.
Sounds awful. They keep him as a slave. That's a good kid lesson to have. It sounds like Pod People, the old MST3K one.
Yeah. Children.
Trumpy.
Yeah. Children in movies back in the day, they were always just finding creatures and keeping them as slaves.
Enslaving them. Yeah. Kids were jerks back then. Well, there's a lot of jerk kids now, but that's mainly jerks on film.
Next up on DVD, Tim Ritter's 1985 horror anthology, Twisted Illusions, limited VHS and DVD release by Sub Rosa Studios. So this is a very hard-to-find early film from Tim Ritter, who went on to direct Truth or Dare and Killing Spree, I think both of which were reviewed on the show.
Mm-hmm.
7 short stories are presented in this anthology movie inspired by Creepshow and The Twilight Zone. Anything from an ear of corn to a vacuum cleaner are taken from their normal use and turned into a twisted illusion. And don't forget our resident psycho, who even makes Norman Bates look sane. So this release includes a DVD and a VHS for $25 and is limited to only 50 copies. So act quick if you want to get on this.
Yeah, act very quick. That's not enough copies for everybody.
Yeah, that's not nearly enough copies. It's going to be 49 as soon as I get to it.
And 48 after Mark gets to it. I liked this guy a lot. I liked Killing Spree a great deal. I liked Truth or Dare mostly. And I still retain that no actual violence happened in that movie, which is why I like it a lot. I like that kind of stuff. I think, anyway. I could be totally wrong about that, but that's what I'm going with. That's what it seemed like to me. I like this guy. This I will try to watch this if I am lucky enough to be one of the 50.
Yeah, I think it's pretty cool now that we're living in an age where these super obscure shot-on-video horror movies are finally getting re-released and are relatively, you know, more easy to come by. I guess 50 copies is not that easy, but it's better than the alternative, which I'm not even sure that this had a proper U.S. release ever. It's one of those really early ones from him. So I'm looking forward to it, if nothing else.
Yeah, that'll be fun. So now we're going to get into the junk mail part of the show, because we forgot to do it before the nerd news, because I'm not as good as Kevin at doing this show. The first piece of junk mail we have is from Augustine. Augustine says, I just wanted to extend a thank you for producing such a great show. Well, thank you. I found the show after the demise of Mondo Movie. I guess they're back now, ? After which I listened to quite a few genre podcasts that just didn't work for me. I was really taken by your natural delivery of humor and information without ever getting pretentious. Thank you. Anyway, please keep them coming. Suggestions include a sweet movie, which sounds sweet.
Sounds pretty sweet.
It's got John Vernon's Golden Dick, a beauty contest for the prettiest hymen, and a feast that must be seen to be believed. That sounds great. Second, I would like to suggest The Beast by a guy whose last name I cannot pronounce, so I won't try. It's a raging, oversexed version of Beauty and the Beast, where the Beast is so horny he rapes trees and unloads gallons of beast jizz all over the forest. These movies sound perfect. The beauty of this film is prior to filming, the director had been a respected artist and was even nominated for the Palme d'Or. With this film, he effectively committed creative suicide and was never held in high esteem again. That sounds delightful to me. Have you guys heard of either of these movies?
No, but this email is rubbing you all the right ways. It gave you suggestions for the show, gave a pretty astute summary, and is also recommending these really insane films that sound amazing.
I love the contrast in that email between a very polite intro and then these sound like extremely disgusting film recommendations.
Yeah. Very fond of your show. Beast jism all over the forest.
Hello, good sirs. Allow me to make your acquaintance and tell you about the golden dick of John Vernon.
The most beautiful hymen in the world. Both these movies sound really rad. Like, sweet is an apt title for the first one. And what's the second one called?
The Beast.
The Beast. Short and sweet names, too.
Yeah. I will check those out. The next junk mail we have is from Blake Sell, a friend of Pool Party Radio. You go through the whole schlemiel on Hologram Man without once making any mention of the only thing that sticks out in my mind about the movie, Coffee Table Violence, which is a good name for a band. Coffee tables appear and get killed several times for no reason, and it's the best and most important part of the movie. It's one of the only reasons to have seen it in the theater, which is astounding to have seen this in the theater. I thought it went straight to Showtime or something. Thanksgiving 2/3 is one of the few movies that I have walked out of this year. Boo. Boo you, Blake Sell. Others are Casa de Mi Padre and Trick or Treat, not because it was bad, but it was super late. I do now regret walking out on it because I don't remember hearing that awesome song during the intro. That song was actually not part of the movie, so the only thing that Blake Sell wanted to see was actually not part of it. Blake Sell doesn't like puppets, is the gist of this. I love Thanksgiving 3. I know that I'm the only person that does. Letterboxd has told me I'm the only person who likes that movie.
Oh, you actually saw it. I saw it, too, over Thanksgiving.
Oh, yeah?
No less. Yeah, but I was battling a sinus infection and kept falling asleep on the couch. So I think that's probably the best way to view that movie, though, since the movie is like a two-hour fever dream. So it makes complete sense to like go in and out and be like, "Oh, is this real life or what's happening?" That movie is insane. You've seen it too, Sean?
Yeah, that is a crazy movie. And while I did really enjoy it, I will probably never watch it again. And my experience watching it was I could only handle it in about 30-minute chunks, and then I would have to take a break, go for a walk, think about my life, reevaluate some decisions I've made up to this point, and then I was ready to go back to it. But I did enjoy it. It was a bit of an overload of a film. It's so loud and there's so much going on at all times that it's a little crazy.
And it looks great too. Like compared to Thanksgiving 1, like the visual style of this movie is just out of this world. And I love the jokes that I heard and woke up for. Like there is some, it is pretty good writing for what it is, whatever it is. But yeah, it's one of those things where it's like I like your style. I'd have to come back after short breaks every 30 minutes.
I was impressed, you know, on that kind of budget. They actually did stretch it really well, and yeah, I don't get all the hate for it. I think it's a pretty funny movie, and I think it deserves a look.
It's very funny. I've seen it 3 times already, and I always laugh out loud when the worm Rhonda talks about how his friend had worminal cancer. That's funny.
Those worm puns are pretty good.
Of course, Parker's a fan of the worm puns. I forgot.
It's playing playing theatrically here in LA next week.
Oh, so, yeah?
Yeah.
Whoa.
If you can get down to Burbank next week.
I think I'm going to try. That would be awesome. I would love to see that movie.
I feel like if for anybody who hasn't seen the movie, would it be right to assume that like if you like The Forbidden Zone, you'd probably like Thanksgiving 3? Or did you not like The Forbidden Zone?
I didn't really like The Forbidden Zone. I like some of it. I think I like it now in retrospect. Like it's been like two or three years since I've seen it. We actually did it on Junk Food Dinner #1.
Mm-hmm.
I think maybe I like it now in retrospect, but when I was watching it, I didn't like it. But yeah, very similar sorts of things. Very weird, very musical, very bizarre films. The next junk mail we have is from Buckethead. A few weeks ago, we were talking about who our favorite kids in the hall were and how we would rank them. Buckethead says that he doesn't really care for the kids in the hall, so he's going to rank... Well, he says he hated them when he was growing up, but hasn't watched it since, so he doesn't know for sure. So he's going to rank the state. He likes Thomas Lennon, Ken Marino, Joe Latrulio, Carrie Kenney, Robert Grant, Michael Ian Black, Showalter, David Wayne. Showalter, so low. I love that Showalter. Kevin Allison, Michael Patrick Jan, and Todd Hollebeck. I think the one thing we can all agree on is that Todd is the worst member of the state.
I don't even remember Todd, to be honest. Was Todd the guy with like the shoulder-length brown hair split down the middle?
No, that's Michael Patrick Jan. Todd Hollebeck's chicken sandwich, Carl.
Oh, no.
That's the only thing. Yeah, I know. He's terrible.
I don't remember. But yeah, that's a pretty good list, though.
Yeah. It seems like a safe bet to me that most people would agree that Tom Lennon is the best.
He's pretty great. I think I like him the best just because of Porcupine Racetrack, but I do like Ken Marino a great deal.
Yeah, he was high up there though, wasn't he? He was like two down from Lennon.
Yeah, something like that. I love that sketch where they pretend that Ken Marino died, and they play all those clips of him and stuff. That's so good. Anyway,
Showalter's. Oh god.
Oh well, yeah. So we should get to another voicemail as we've gone on for too long. Here is the first voicemail. It is from Stefan.
Hello, this is Stefan. I'm from planet Earth, and I was thinking for the holiday, you should do something by Al Adamson. Why, you may ask? Because he was the son of Adam, first man created by God. And the selection should obviously be Satan's Sadist. Just listen to this. Okay, so it's a very tangential connection, but the holiday season. Satan's in there, though. You gotta love it. Take it easy. Love the show.
Well, thank you very much, Stefan.
The song ruled. I'm surprised how good quality it was over the phone. Do you guys get a lot of, like, people playing stuff for you?
No, I think
voicemails?
I think that was the first time. It's very meta to play a voicemail on a podcast where we play clips... And then the guy in the voicemail is playing a clip that we're playing on the show, where we play clips.
Yeah, that was a really well-produced voicemail there.
Yeah.
And I think the guy makes some really cogent points about Al Adamson.
I agree.
I'm looking at this guy's IMDb, and I can honestly say of the 50 or so titles on here, I've only seen Black Samurai, which might be the worst blaxploitation movie I've ever seen. So, if that's any indication, I'd say we got a winner.
Yeah, that sounds great.
Do you have plans for a Christmas show for a junk food dinner?
Indeed. We'll be doing Saint, Babes in Toyland, and something else. Some old grandpa movie that Mark picked.
Babes in Toyland? Isn't that a
Drew Barrymore movie too?
Yeah, Drew Barrymore and Keanu Reeves.
Oh, yeah, Keanu's in that.
Yeah, but yeah, Mark picked some movie from like the 40s or something, and you know what I said when I heard that he was going to pick that movie?
I know it was you, Fredo. You broke my heart.
I feel like Mark has a chance to defend himself here. Do we have like a robotic stand-in for him, a robo-Fredo, by any chance?
This is garbage.
It's not helping anything.
Well, he thinks it's garbage that I am opposed to old movies.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that works then.
Yeah. Oh, also this.
Parker, you dick.
This next voicemail does not have a transcript, so let's just play it.
Hey, what's up, guys? It's Kevin, reporting from the road. I'm actually driving through Wisconsin right now, leaving Minnesota. Sorry I couldn't be on the show this week, but even in my absence, I have to weasel my voice in on the show somehow. But I had to call for a couple reasons. One, I had to wish Parker a happy birthday. Happy birthday, buddy. I'm sorry I can't be there to wish it to you in person. You know, turning 47 is no joke. Everyone's got to do it at some point. But, you know, we're just glad that you're still with us and, you know, kicking in those puns every week. So happy birthday, buddy. I will, I'll pick up some cheese here in Wisconsin and mail it to you, as a birthday wish. I'm also sad that I can't be there to talk to Sean Byron live in person. I know he'll do a great job filling in. And I want to take this opportunity to thank Sean for all his contributions to the show, whether it be, you know, promoting the show via Facebook, or just watching the movies along with us and sending us emails and commenting on Facebook. He is a true, definition of the word, supporter of the show. So, thank you, Sean, for being on the show, and, I hope I'm there next time to talk to you. But yeah, I hope you guys have fun reviewing these post-apocalyptic movies without me. I'll talk to you guys next week. But, Sean, thanks for being there, and Parker, happy birthday, and I will, talk to you guys later. Alright, take it easy, guys. Bye.
Well, this is Kevin.
Yeah, thanks for the happy birthday wishes. This Kevin Moss wrote me a nice message on the Facebook for my birthday. It really helped out my self-esteem that day. It was very nice of him.
Yeah, what a sweet guy, although I think he probably should have waited until after this episode to claim that I would do a good job.
You're doing just fine.
Also, I'm glad to hear that he's taking the quick route to Boston through Wisconsin.
Yeah, he's somebody needs to turn him around. He's getting lost in all that winter storm stuff.
Well, you know, sometimes you got to take the scenic route to Boston, Massachusetts.
Through Canada. That's right. Yeah. You start out in Cincinnati, and you drive northwest, and then you get lost, and then Boston.
Yeah. Well, he probably had to go to, like, the Jelly Belly factory in Wisconsin first. They let you take free tours.
True. Yeah.
Yeah.
This last detour.
Yeah, this last voicemail is from Jordan.
Hey guys, this is Jordan from the podcast Olympic Artichoke Radio, which was actually inspired by your show, so thanks for that. Anyway, just got done listening to episode 138. Good job. Don't think I'll be watching Thanksgiving 3, but it's good to know a little bit about it. Anyway, I wrote into you guys a little while back about watching the movie The Last Slumber Party, which you have yet to do, but I think you should. And, well, anyway, just calling to tell you guys, you're doing a great job. Love the show. I was going to maybe recommend the movie Outpost, which is stars Ray Stevenson. It's a Nazi zombie ghost movie. It's pretty good. Ray Stevenson from Punisher Warzone, which I just recently watched on the recommendation from Parker on whatever episode that was. That movie is totally rad. I love it. So thanks for that too. Anyway, keep up the good work. I think the show is amazing, and I hope you do another 138 episodes.
Well, thank you very much. In this transcript, this Google Voice transcript, it says, I hope you do another 113 episodes. So I think Google doesn't like us nearly as much as you do. That's weird.
Or Google only likes 113 of your episodes.
Yeah.
It's like those first couple were pretty rough.
Yeah, that's probably true. Google's pretty accurate on that.
Keep doing the good 113, not the bad few that you did.
Yeah. So. Yeah, this movie with Ray Stevenson sounds good to me. I've never seen it, but I love Ray Stevenson. He was great in that Punisher, and he's on Dexter right now, and he's the best thing to happen on Dexter in like 3 years, and I just bought the first season of Rome because he's in it. So I love that guy. He's maybe one of my favorite actors. He's no Julian Sands yet, but he's getting there. If he plays like a warlock or a robot soon. Then,
or he boxes a Helena.
Yeah, or yeah, if he starts cutting off the arms and legs of beautiful ladies, then maybe. Have you guys seen Outpost?
No, I have not, no. But I've seen Punisher Warzone. And I agree with the both of yous that it's a fine film. He looks the most like a Punisher.
That's true. I think he's probably my favorite Punisher. I think I said once on the show that Thomas Jane was, but I think I just love Thomas Jane. I think the best Punisher is probably Ray Stevenson.
The Thomas Jane Short, though, that was pretty excellent, too.
Oh, that was so good. Yeah, check out Olympic Artichoke Radio. I follow them on Letterboxd, so they're good dudes. Check them out. Without further ado, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we will talk about the Bronx Warriors.
Shortly after we recorded this episode, Mark was murdered and set on fire while celebrating his birthday.
No, he wasn't actually. But how are you to know? The only sure way to stay up to date with JFD is to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Social networks are the best way to get all the JFD news about upcoming shows, side projects, murders, and arsons. Also, we like you and just want to chat sometimes, you know? Facebook.com/junkfooddinner and @junkfooddinner on Twitter.
You and I know each other. You found me on the internet.
Battlefield. 1990, the Bronx Warriors. They trust no one. They fear nothing. Those who follow them will survive. Those who challenge them will die. It's a future ruled by the strong. A future where the first to perish are the lucky ones. 1990, the Bronx Warriors.
Welcome back to Junk Food Dinner. The first movie we'll be doing is The Bronx Warriors. 1990, : The Bronx Warriors. This is an Italian film directed by Enzo G. Castellari. I think the name Enzo is super sweet. My friend Julie has a baby named Enzo. Cool name. This movie is from 1982. It concerns Anne. She is the 17-year-old heiress to the arms manufacturing giant, the Manhattan Corporation, unable to face her guilt over inheriting a morally questionable company. When she turns 18, Anne runs away into the lawless wasteland of the New York's Bronx. Described as, in the year 1990, the Bronx is officially declared no man's land. The authorities give up all attempts to restore law and order. From then on, the area is ruled by the rioters. I'm reading this from Wikipedia, by the way, which I don't normally do, but for this movie, I'm doing it. Attacked by a roller skating gang called the Zombies, which is a cool name for a gang, Anne is saved by members of the Riders and is taken under the protection of the Riders' leader, Trash. The Manhattan Corporation hires a ruthless and psychotic mercenary named Hammer. Everybody's got cool names in this. Who turns the various Bronx gangs on each other to ensure Anne is returned. This is a movie that I think I saw some of way back in the day when I lived with Blake Sell, as I think he owned this. But I might be confusing it with The New Gladiators, which also stars Fred Williamson and is also Italian and is also about the end of the world.
In New York or just the end of the world in general?
I think that one's just in general. It might be in New York as well. But yeah, this stars Fred Williams. Well, sort of stars Fred Williamson. He plays Ogre, which is a cool name. We also have dudes named Ice, Golem, Hot Dog. A lot of cool names in this.
Yeah, Italian films are... Italian, like, end-of-the-world films are really well-known for their cool names. Like, Video Game. Do you remember that one from Rats?
Although, to be honest, you know, it must suck to have the name Trash, because if somebody's addressing you by that name, you don't know if they're trying to talk wise to you or if they're just addressing you by your name.
It's true.
Someone's like, hey, Trash, what are you doing? You don't know, you know, what's their intent there?
Yeah, it's an unfortunate name to be sure, because he looks so confused in this film whenever somebody addresses him.
Yeah, that guy, Mark Gregory, has pretty much no acting ability whatsoever, as I'm sure we'll get into.
Yeah, when this movie, you know, it started out, and I was very excited because it has some of the best opening credits I think I've ever seen. There's a lot of, like, close-ups of weapons and roller skates and, like, foxy lady parts and stuff. It was real cool, and it sucked me in.
Yeah, you don't like the Warriors, but go on.
I like the Warriors.
Oh, okay.
When did I ever say I don't like the Warriors? What are you talking about? You're getting me mixed up.
I'm not trying to rustle your jimmies, man. I'm just thinking. I'm thinking you said you didn't like it.
Nah, you're rustling all my jimmies. I'm upset. I love the Warriors. Right. There's this awesome scene where a guy has died and people start congregating around on docks to look at his dead body. And a dude's just playing a drum solo during it.
Same rules.
Yeah, that is awesome. That's a good scene. Yeah, you know, I like movies like this. Movies. This came out in 82. And around this time, like, it was just, it's so beautiful to me to think that people who lived in Italy would be like, let's make a movie about the end of the world. Where can we go on the cheap that looks like the end of the world? Let's go to New York City. Like, that's depressing if your town looks like the apocalypse, I feel.
I thought it was amusing that this movie's called The Bronx Warriors, and clearly they shot most of the movie in Roosevelt Island or Brooklyn. I couldn't see any shots that looked like the Bronx to me.
Yeah.
I couldn't tell the difference. I actually confused the Bronx and Brooklyn frequently. I thought Pot Awful host Jeff CPS was from the Bronx, and he got really insulted.
Yeah, if you can see the Twin Towers, as you see like 5,000 times in this movie, mm-hmm. you're probably not in the Bronx.
Yeah.
But I like that the Twin Towers made so many appearances that they celebrated it towards the end of the film with a Twin Towers cake.
Exactly.
As like an award for like most Twin Towers appearances in one film. Here's a cake.
Give it up, guys. Let's cut into it.
Yeah. That honor either goes to this or Spider-Man 1, the Sam Raimi one. There's a lot of Twin Towers in there. A lot of flags draped over the Twin Towers and stuff. In this is perhaps one of the wussiest gangs. Speaking of the Warriors, I would love to see the Broadway gang from this movie take on the orphans from the Warriors to find out who the wussiest gang ever is.
I would still say it's the orphans. I don't understand the Bob Fosse gang that shows up, because they have a lot of time to get their uniforms and glitter just right.
Yeah, even that first gang with their spandex and their white helmets and their roller skates just looks ridiculous, and it gets worse from there.
Yeah, these gangs look really, like, they look really sissy in this, and, like, even the sissy gangs in the Warriors, which this rips off heartily.
Yes.
You know, even the wussiest gangs, aside from the orphans, who are, like, extremely wussy, but even the wussiest ones, like, you know, if you were to be like, hey, there's these guys who dress up like baseball players and they're a gang, I'd be like, oh, that sounds wussy. But when you see them, you're like, oh my god, these guys are tough. I would hate to fight these guys. But in this movie, there really aren't a lot of, like, I was not in fear for any of these gangs. Like, pretty much everybody looked like wussies. Like, there was, like, that gang that, like, all wore spandex. And, yeah, I don't know. Like, these guys just kind of looked weird and not very frightening for being...
You weren't frightened by the glowing Halloween plastic skulls on the headlights of the motorcycles?
Actually, yeah, that was pretty cool. I like those guys. Those guys were probably one of the toughest motorcycle gangs we've talked about on the show, I would think.
There's plenty of them, too. I actually found that there was a Hell's Angels chapter from New York. They were encouraged to come by and show up for the set.
Mm-hmm.
they made fun of the lead actor the way that he walked.
Yeah.
They openly mocked him during shooting. Like, look at this guy. Stuck up his butt.
Yeah, I was watching an interview with Fred Williamson about this movie on the DVD, and he was talking about how he and the director had to spend so much time teaching that guy how to walk tough because he walked very wussy.
It didn't work.
Yeah.
No, it did not. Yeah. It's
There's a great credit in the credit sequence at the beginning that says, action sequences by the Hell's Angels and Rocky Stuntman Team. It's like, what? Who's Rocky's Stuntman Team, and why are they hanging out with the Hell's Angels?
It sounds like a circus act, hanging out with a group of vicious bikers. It's probably about accurate. But.
Yeah, I think Rocky Stuntman is a cool name, though. Yeah, the main guy in this looks like a real, like, kind of a sissy version of Ajax from The Warriors, who was also already kind of, like, not the toughest guy in the world. Yeah, this, like, on all the covers, like the cover of the DVD and this poster here on Wikipedia, this guy looks, like, ripped and super tough, and then when you start watching the movie, he's like, he maybe weighs 80 pounds, and apparently he's the owner of the sole bottle of shampoo left after the apocalypse and stuff like this. A real wussy guy.
And what strikes me is, like, they're definitely going for the look and aesthetic of The Warriors, but they really like the story of Escape from New York, which is basically the same thing. It's like you have to rescue this dignitary sort. It's not the president, but it's going to be, you know, an important dude's daughter. And that's the movie. That's a lot of it.
Yeah, that's basically it. Like,
and then Shaft shows up because he's also associated with, like, urban blight.
Yeah, and then Fred Williamson also wears a shirt that looks exactly like Lando Calrissian's shirt. So I think.
Oh, you mean that ridiculous puffy pirate shirt that he wears towards the end?
Yeah,
but it's still tough as hell, though.
Yeah, that's pretty remarkable. If you can look tough with a puffy pirate shirt, you're doing something right.
Yeah,
but you know he's a badass because he has like 100 candles lit in his hideout, even though it's broad daylight with all the windows open.
Yeah, he got a gift card for Bath and Body Works, so you know he had to spend it somewhere. Also, in the interview I was watching with Fred Williamson, he talked about how they wanted to kill him in this movie, and the only way he would let that happen is if he could die on a throne. And I think that's pretty metal. That's a metal thing to request. Spoiler alert as well, by the way. Huge spoiler. There's a time in this movie where a guy tells another guy that it's illegal to bullshit a cop, which is very funny. I think that's a weird law. There's a time when they're in the Tiger's territory, and, you know, one of these guys, like, pulls himself up out of a manhole, and you can see Manhattan in the background. And there are tons of cars driving to and fro on the streets of Manhattan. So that's some good guerrilla filmmaking there for your apocalypse movie, to not cut out the hundreds of cars driving around behind your guy. Also, there's a few very funny insults in this movie. A guy calls another guy a pisshead. I think that's funny. And then he calls a different guy in the same scene a fag face, which is also funny.
So the script was written by 12-year-olds. This is what I'm getting.
Yeah, it was written by the guys who were doing the beta testing for Xbox Live.
All dialogue comes from Call of Duty.
Yeah, I think this movie is fun. It's a lot like 2019 After the Fall of New York, which we did on episode 19 or 18 or something like that. Very Italian, very much, you know, ripping off stuff like The Warriors and Escape from New York, and very much people being dubbed even though they're already speaking English for some reason, which is always weird. I like movies like this. I think I'm pretty biased towards end of the world movies, so I care for these a great deal. I don't think this is as good as After the Fall of New York, which I say not so much arbitrarily. I think they can be compared to each other as they come in the same box set that I own, so I don't think it's unfair to compare the two. But this is certainly a fun movie. I mean, it's no 2019, it's no Warriors, it's no Escape from New York. But if you don't have those and you're in a pinch for something like those, I think this will do you well.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think this is, you know, not a good movie in any traditional sense of the word, but it's, you know, it's probably more than enough fun to make up for that. It's got all the trademarks of Italian cinema, like big hair, bad dialogue, tight jeans, inappropriate musical cues. Like that drummer that you mentioned in that one scene, apparently from what I read, that was not part of the script. It was not planned at all. Just when they showed up to that neighborhood, they noticed a guy carrying a drum and they asked him to be in the scene. And don't really explain it at all whatsoever. But stuff like that is what, you know, what I think is interesting about Italian films of this period is that they had kind of an openness and a willingness to try anything, and you get good results if you're open to things like that.
The drummer scene was so I don't know how to put it, like enriching. It was rewarding, I guess. Like, it comes early on in the film, and when it happens, the shots around the drummer and the way like the drum kicks in, it's like that nice kind of like gritty recording of it. It's awesome, and I was just hoping that the film was going to be all of that, but instead, yeah, it's all the same pitfalls of like the bad dialogue, which, to be fair, like Parker's, and you're right that this is it's a lot of fun. Like when you watch it, I mean, it ends up being fun. It wasn't meant to be that way, but like, who is it when Hammer addresses his friend Hot Dog, and he tries to just be natural about it, like, "Hey, Hot Dog, hi, Hot Dog," like back to back. It's like, Jesus, this doesn't work, but it's hilarious sounding. Like a grown man calling another grown man Hot Dog. And also there's cops in the truck saying, "Better get a move on, those punks are tough." After they've been like cursing up a storm, they decide to tone it down to PG-13 by saying, "Oh, those guys are tough."
Those fellows.
I think one of my favorite lines came shortly after that drummer scene. There's a drunk homeless guy urinating on the sidewalk who looks over at one of the main characters and says, "This here is a respectable neighborhood."
Yeah.
And just the line reading is perfect. I also like the part where Fred Williamson's gang arrives to what could be a battle or just kind of a meetup between a rival gang. And these guys all show up in, you know, fancy pimped out cars. They got like fancy suits on. They're looking dressed to the nines. But half of them are like outside the cars, clinging to the side of the car because apparently they didn't have enough cars. Just not very pimp at all.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's very frugal rather than pimp. Like, it's old-timey gangsters. Yeah.
And there's so many like bad fake mustaches in this movie that I lost count. And the only thing that can make a bad fake mustache look worse is if you put fake blood on it, which they do a few times in this. And you just get this weird, like, matted... It looks like a dead cat on your face.
Yeah, Fred Williamson's mustache is sweet, though. It looks like the Batman symbol.
Yeah. I couldn't tell if... I know that he has, like, a pretty badass mustache in a lot of the films, but it looked to me like he might have had mustache extensions put on for this film, because it's... If you look, it goes down, like, a good inch further than it normally does.
Yeah.
I noticed that, too. Yeah, it's a bit bolder than usual.
Yeah, it like goes down in two little points. Like it's very weird. It's a very weird mustache, but I like it. I'm gonna try to get mine like that.
There's also a great part where the bikers throw the ashes of one of their own gang members into the East River, and about 0% of it actually reaches the water. It just kind of blows back in their face.
Like Coen Brothers stole that.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure the Coens saw this.
Yeah.
Yeah, setting this in 1990 was pretty cool. Although, when I first saw the DVD cover, I was kind of hoping that there would be a comma in between the 1 and the 9, because if there was almost 2,000 Bronx Warriors in this movie, that would be sweet. Comma jokes, everybody. Comma jokes.
So, when I was watching this film, it reminded me a lot of a documentary called 80 Blocks from Tiffany's. I don't know if you guys have heard of that documentary. It came out around the same time as the Warriors, and kind of chronicles the actual real conditions in the Bronx at that time, and showcases what gang culture was like at that time. And it's so similar to this film that it actually makes this film not look like a science fiction film. It kind of just looks like a very slight exaggeration of what the reality was at the time.
Yeah, I've heard of that, but I haven't seen it. But I would imagine that a lot of these movies, the Warriors and stuff like that, like they probably come off to make parts of New York a lot more charming than they were when they actually happened. It's probably a lot more dangerous in real life than in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot more apocalyptic looking.
Yeah, you definitely get to see a lot more of New York than in The Warriors. Like, The Warriors has some pretty close shots in, like, subway scenes and stuff like that. I think the only real scenic shot that sticks out in my mind is Coney Island. It's like the big, broad reveal.
Mm-hmm.
But in this movie, I mean, they're just going on their bikes past dilapidated buildings. I mean, stuff is just falling apart. There's cars in the distance, yeah. Like, civilization is still going on, but there's obviously a lot of deterioration going on, people just leaving blocks entirely.
Yeah, they did a good job of showing off the terrible look of New York in this. And some of it was filmed in Italy, too, and they kind of, like, put them together, like, to make it seem that, you know, to make it so that you couldn't really tell which was Italy and which was New York. And, yeah, I mean, this movie kind of seems more like New York than something. I mean, like, The Warriors is very New York-y, but there are a lot of scenes in, like, Central Park and stuff where you're like, that could just be any park. Like, that isn't, that's not necessarily Central Park. And, like, that could be any subway anywhere.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, they were pretty smart to put the New York skyline behind most of the exterior scenes. You know, they shot, I think, a few scenes on a bridge where you can see the skyline, and then a lot of those ones on Roosevelt Island where you can see lower Manhattan.
Yeah.
And the only time they have, like, a false one is when, like you mentioned earlier, the cake skyline. And it's when they're hanging out in the famous grottos of New York. Oops.
Yeah, I was making fun of them for, you know, showing the skyline, yet, you know, despite the fact that there are a bunch of cars driving around, which obviously wouldn't be happening after the apocalypse. But, yeah, I mean, you know, if you were to take those out, it would detract a lot from the movie, as the skylines were very cool. If you just ignore the cars, it works really, really well.
What did you guys think of the action in this movie?
Go ahead.
Fred Williamson was probably most in tune with it. From, like, the fight scenes I saw, was he was most in line. I almost thought that he was actually connecting when some of those, like, fists being thrown. But otherwise, I mean, yeah, the hockey gang, the roller hockey gang, they're fighting dudes. They're fighting the writers with, like, lead pipes and stuff, you know. So how much is a hockey stick going to do against a lead pipe? They try to make it work. I don't think it was that great. What about you guys?
Yeah, I thought some of the fights were cool. Fred Williamson's fights were really cool. And there were, like, a couple of scenes. Like, this one guy shoots a couple of dudes on, like, on some stairs. And that looked really cool and metal.
Oh. That's the one where he pulls the shotgun out of the poster tube.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that's pretty badass, because it's like a variation on the old, like, shotgun in the rose bouquet trick. You know, he's got it in a mm-hmm. poster tube instead.
Yeah, I thought that was pretty cool.
I think my favorite action scene was one that kind of happens in the background. They're all riding their motorcycles towards one of the destinations in the film. And it's not really focused on. It kind of happens in the background. You see this guy fall off his motorcycle pretty hardcore and spin around. And I just caught it out of the corner of my eye. I thought, oh, that looks interesting. And then I looked it up online, and it turns out that was not planned, that the guy just fell off his motorcycle and they decided to keep it in. So
that sounds pretty sweet. I'll have to look for that next time.
And I think there was one good decapitation as well.
Yeah. There's some good fights near the end when things start popping off.
Did you guys hear the story about Mark Gregory, the guy that plays Trash, the lead character in this film?
Mm-mm.
So apparently he disappeared in 1989, and the director of this film and its sequel, which I think Mark Gregory's in as well, had been looking for him ever since, looking all across Italy for the guy, and just he had completely dropped off the face of the planet. Interestingly enough, shortly before he disappeared, he was in Tenzan, The Ultimate Mission, which is a 1988 North Korean action movie produced by Kim Il-sung. Weird. So there were some theories out there that the North Koreans had him taken out or something. But a super fan of this movie, who has a website, bronxwarriors.co.uk, spent about 8 years tracking him down and finally found him just a few months ago. And but he has a picture on the site of oh, here's the guy I found. This is trash. And I'm really skeptical. If you check it out, doesn't look anything like the guy. But
didn't the director like try to – he put a MP3 on the site or something and was trying to just get like a message out there? Like, if you're listening to this, we miss you, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, that's what I saw too. So pretty interesting, but I'm not really convinced.
Well, now I'm very convinced of something now, and that's that we have to go to war with North Korea, and we got to get Mark Gregory back at all costs.
This was also the second to last film for Vic Morrow, who died a year later while filming the Twilight Zone movie.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So the hammer is his legacy.
Yeah.
Well, I think that about wraps it up for these Bronx Warriors. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be back to talk about a boy, also his dog. So stick around.
Remember that time we burned you that Ween CD and had your back in that bar fight and gave you hundreds of free podcasts? Well, it's time to return the favor, bro. Search iTunes for Junk Food Dinner or follow the link on junkfooddinner.com. Then subscribe to the show, give us a 5-star rating, and leave a review with nice words and exclamation points. Now we're even.
I think this is the beginning of a beautiful friendship.
Charles Chaplin of the Los Angeles Times says, a coherent, alternate world, kind of a funny nightmare recited as upcoming fact. It is an offbeat delight. KMET Radio, Los Angeles. Gripping, horrific, a bitter vision of tomorrow. Tightly controlled, compelling, bizarre, and witty. Time Magazine's Richard Schickel says, ironic, risks being absurd, yet compels respect for some witty writing and well-paced direction. Roger Ebert of the Chicago Sun-Times says, wacky success, weird, offbeat, unique, magnificently inspired. Richard Eder of the New York Times says, brilliantly grotesque. The Austin Sun, this may be the best science fiction film ever made. A boy and his dog. A film that has become a cult legend.
Right now I'm hungry and I want to get laid.
That's what you always say.
You go find a chick and I'll hustle us up some food.
I can't do good work when I'm hungry.
You ain't pulling that crap on me again. And you can shove that part about how you lost the ability to hunt for food when you learned how to talk.
No food, no females.
After World War IV, your dog will tell you what to do. How to laugh, how to love, how and who to kill.
That stupid broad.
You're so funny when you're sexually frustrated.
Damn it. When the hell am I going to nail her in there?
Simple. Stop shaking like a leaf and go do it.
If you continue to find the food for your dog, He will find you a woman. He is the only one who can.
Give him the girl.
We stay. Now, you got any helpful suggestions?
Yes, pull up your pants, Romeo.
In the future, your dog will tell you how to survive. Or you will die.
A woman can't get pregnant. Every once in a while, we need new blood.
Horse manure.
You mean you want me to knock up your broad?
Well, I can push back the wrong attitude, fair to the authority.
Now, get the dramatic catch out of your voice and tell me how she's going to carry her share of the load up here. Tell me how we're going to fight her.
All right, okay. Just don't hang her.
Harangue, not hang her.
I don't care whatever the hell it is. You just knock off the crap and we can forget the whole stinking...
Well, maybe we should, you simple dumb putz.
What the hell's a putz? What's a putz? Is that something bad? I bet it is. It's something bad. I'll tell you, you better watch your stinking mouth or I'm going to kick you in the butt.
If you can imagine an excuse for World War IV, you will understand a talking dog.
Try to get back as quick as I can. Will you wait?
For a while, then over the hill. I'll miss you, Pig. I'll really miss you.
L.Q. Jones, A Boy and His Dog. A film that has become a legend by word of mouth. Rated R.
Welcome back to the show. Next up tonight is A Boy and His Dog, a film directed by L.Q. Jones from 1975, not to be confused with A Boy and His Blob, a Nintendo game from 1989. This movie stars Don Johnson in his first real film role, so it's probably a must-watch for all you Nash Bridges fans out there. The movie starts out with a young Don Johnson playing a character named Vic, roaming around like a desolate desert landscape with his dog, who's named Blood. Vic and Blood can communicate telepathically, although strangely, it seems like only in one direction as Don Johnson says his lines out loud, where the dog is just kind of transmitting his thoughts to Vic. Anyhow, Vic is complaining to Blood that he hasn't gotten laid in 6 weeks, and that Blood, who apparently has some kind of ability to sense the presence of nearby human females, he's complaining that he should help him seek out a mate. They visit some strange old porno theater together where Blood detects a female nearby. Things are kind of weird at this point in the film, but eventually they bump into the woman. Her name is Quilla, and it turns out that she's from an underground society, literally situated under the ground. Before Vic gets a chance to execute on his plan of raping Quilla, they get surrounded by a band of screamers, which is some kind of ill-defined gang of sorts, I guess. After he saves her from the gang, Quilla invites Vic to visit her underground society. But because the dog got injured in the battle with the screamers, this means Vic will have to leave his dog behind. They have like a tear-filled moment where he promises to return to his dog, but then he joins Quilla in the underground city. When we arrive in the underground city, we see that all the residents are wearing creepy clown makeup and are dressed in like Norman Rockwell type 1950s clothing. There's like creepy clown faced marching bands, creepy clown faced cheerleaders, and the leaders of the town seem to have maybe questionable intents. Things start to really develop from there, but I don't want to spoil it too much, so I'll probably just leave it at that. This is not a film I'd ever seen before, but it's one I'd been meaning to see for a long time. I'd heard a lot of good things about it. I think it's pretty well regarded as a classic post-apocalyptic movie. I knew that it was written by Harlan Ellison, who's a relatively well-respected writer from science fiction and comics. I think he also worked on the Twilight Zone TV series. Having seen it now, I can say I was somewhat underwhelmed by it, although I did enjoy some of the twists that happened later on in the film. So what do you guys think about A Boy and His Dog?
Well, I have been wanting to see this for a long time, being a fan of apocalypse movies and stuff, and especially being a fan of the Fallout games, which I've always heard this was a big influence on those games. Mm. And seeing it now, yeah, like this... Not only a big influence on Fallout itself, but this was a huge influence, I'm sure, on every other thing about the apocalypse that has ever come out.
Yeah. Also, that last, like, 30 or the last half of the film that takes place in the Underground Society. For any fans of Bioshock, like, that's a huge thing that they probably took away. Or at least it's very similar. But because
this is pretty early in the history of post-apocalyptic cinema, I think. You know, I think the defining point is probably Mad Max, which is 79. And after that, you have, like, a lot of post-apocalyptic movies coming out in the 80s, like The Bronx Warriors or Stryker, Turkey Shoot. You know, there's a ton. But this is pretty early. This is 75. And I think because it's so early, the tone is a lot different than other post-apocalyptic movies that came later. I didn't feel like there was anything really menacing about the world that the characters were in, at least initially. It's kind of jokey at points. Like, there's a very light atmosphere. There's more humor than you would expect. They even play, like, silly banjo music under some of the action scenes, which I thought was pretty weird.
Yeah, that stuff is all, like, super 1975. Like, if you're doing, like, this weird banjo music, like this weird folky, like, banjo stuff over people fighting at the end of the world, like, yeah, that's, you can definitely tell this was made in 1975.
Yeah, it almost felt like a Monty Python sketch in a few scenes.
Yeah. But, so yeah, so I'm glad I got to watch this, as I was saying. So much of everything has been influenced by this. Like, there's so much Mad Max in this, so much Fallout, and I think Mad Max and Fallout have, you know, influenced their fair share of everything as well in this genre since then. And also, I wanted to see this because I think along with Society and Death Wish, this is probably the most requested movie that we get on the show. We usually get a lot of emails talking about Do a Boy and His Dog. So,
oh, wow.
Yeah, so I'm glad to have finally seen this, and I was not disappointed. Like, this is pretty great. There's a lot of stuff in it that kind of goes against the greatness. Like, I think the dog has a real shitty voice.
Yeah.
And
they actually auditioned quite a few people for that dog's voice. It's somewhere in, like, the hundreds, 600 or something.
Yeah, he's also, yeah. I mean, he's got a real shitty attitude, too, where he's just cracking wise half the time and calling Don Johnson a putz, which is kind of funny, but
yeah,
he has a lot of Garfield-style jokes that he tries to crack during the runtime of the film.
Yeah, there's that whole scene where he wants lasagna, and he's, like, not a fan of Mondays. Yeah. Yeah, he's a real dickhead, and he's real pretentious, because he, like, speaks Latin and stuff. Like, I don't know. I didn't care for the dog, really.
Plus, he looks like Benji, which just brings back horrible memories from my childhood.
Yeah, they could have got... And, like, yeah, there's a scene where, like, this dog fights another dog, and, like, this dog's, like, all cute and cuddly. Like, they could have got a tougher dog to be, you know, this post-apocalyptic, like, war-torn dog.
That's what I expected. You know, I hadn't seen this, and I had always just assumed it would be, like, a Rottweiler or something like that, not, like, some shaggy dog.
Yeah, it looked like Disney's The Shaggy Dog. That's appropriate. It was. I think that's what the problem was with me too. It's just he looked too cutesy, and he's trying to help young Don Johnson rape women. Like, there's really no. This they're not playing around. He's like, oh, I smell a girl over there. Give me some popcorn.
Yeah, that's. I mean, it's kind of strange for a film to posit like a hero whose like main quest in the film is to find females to savagely rape. You know, I don't know if that's something that Don Johnson is known for. I don't know if he does that on Nash Bridges, but
you obviously have not seen Nash Bridges.
I've never seen Nash Bridges.
That's all the Cheech Marin he did on the show. So.
Yeah, this movie, it's. I guess there's like a lot of controversy and people, you know, just label it misogynistic a lot and dismiss it, I guess, for the fact that the hero spends most of his time raping, which, you know, I can understand not like... I mean, you know, this is the end of the world. Like, I mean, people are killing each other for food out there. I don't think it's, you know... Oh, yeah, he's probably going to do some raping. I don't know. It's the end of the world. The times are tough. There are mutants out there that are going to eat your skin. I don't know. I just thought that it, more than, so, like, being, you know, just like this weird misogyny on the part of the writer, I thought that was just the world that you live in here at the end of the world. You're just going around with your psychic dog raping. That's just the world you live in.
Well, I think if you turn this film off about halfway through, you might have a case for it being misogynistic, because I actually felt like that initially, you know, when Don Johnson meets the female lead, Quilla, And he's intending to rape her, and then, you know, the bad guys show up, and he saves her from the bad guys, and then she forgets about the rape attempt and falls for Don Johnson. And at that point, if you turn it off, that's almost a misogynistic message of like, oh, you know, man is going to save the woman and she's going to fall for him, even if he's a rapist. But I think if you continue to watch the film, what gets revealed in the third or the last third of the film makes it clear that she had intentions, you know, that were a little bit sinister, and it makes more sense what she was up to at that point in time, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, the part where she falls in love with him after almost being raped is, yeah, I was like, oh, come on, the 70s. We could do better than this. So, yeah, at that part, I was, like, kind of on the ball with the whole, this movie is mean. But to speak to that part a little bit, the writer of this, he doesn't, there's a line at the end of the movie, without trying to give too much away, there's a line at the end of the movie which could, I guess, a lot of people say that this is like the crux of the misogyny in the movie, like this line at the end of the movie that they say, and then the movie, then they roll the credits. And the author doesn't like that. It was something that they added in, the director added in, and the author says that that's what makes this movie misogynistic. But, I mean, if you've written a whole book about how your hero has a dog that helps him find and rape women, you can't really be mad at one line. You can't pinpoint one line and be like, oh, they changed this, so now it takes on a whole nother tone, you know?
So, well, yeah, he's throwing it under the bus in so many words. Like, oh, look at this. Look what they did to my work, my non-misogynistic work. Now it's misogynistic because of that last line.
I mean, I think there's always a tendency for an author to object to any changes in his source material. You know, Stephen King famously hates the Kubrick version of The Shining, but I think everybody other than Stephen King agrees that it's a great film.
Yeah. But, yeah, I don't know. A weird thing for this writer to be upset about. Also, that line is very funny, so whatever.
Yeah, I thought that was the funniest line in the film, and I think that that twist at the end, without giving it away, worked really well. I was surprised by it. I didn't see it coming.
Yeah.
And I think it kind of, you know, it added a lot more to the film. Without that, I think it would have been a much lesser film.
Absolutely, yeah. Without that, like, I was like, oh, yeah, you know, this movie's good. You know, there's some boring parts and the dog sucks. You know, this is all right. This is all right. I respected it as something that influenced a bunch of stuff that I like. But then once that twist hits at the end, I'm like, this is like a next level movie. Like, this is awesome. Like, with that twist, I mean, they kind of, you know, reveal to you, like, I mean, there's been like a lot of fun in this movie, a lot of banjo music and a lot of boys will be boys and stuff. And then, you know, with this thing at the end, you see, oh, no, like, this is the darkest possible world that we live in, you know, like. So I thought that was just fucking great. I love the ending to this.
I'm surprised at how well the actors were in this film. I keep wanting to call him Nash Bridges, but Don Johnson, yeah. He's actually, I thought he was really good. Like, young Don Johnson's good in this film. The one we played, Quillo, is also good. And Jason Robards from left field, like, coming in to play a heavy-hitting character in, like, the last half. That was all, I guess that's the part that stunned me. It was really underwhelming. I mean, you're absolutely right where this is not like The Road Warrior or anything like that. But it does play out exactly like Fallout games. Like, there's going to be a lot of wasteland walking and to deal with situations and talking to people, bartering, yeah, all that stuff.
And that's, you know, obviously that's a more realistic depiction of what a post-apocalyptic society would probably be like. It's not going to be all motorcycles and shotguns. There's going to be a lot of just walking around with a shaggy-looking dog.
Telepathic dog, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then sneaking up on people in the desert and stealing their food. I don't understand how you could sneak up on anybody when you're in the middle of a dry lake in the desert. But
didn't he hit that person with a bag, too? He hit somebody with a bag.
Yeah, doing a lot of sneaking. He must have very high agility and a very high sneak skill dex.
Yeah, but low on intelligence. That's why he's like a +1 intelligence.
Yeah. +10 on rape, though.
You know, speaking of Don Johnson, I think he has one line in this film that would be absolutely perfect as a drop for the show, which is, hey, how would you like to have that rifle rammed up your butt? Which is just like comes out of nowhere, and the the line reading on it is just perfect.
Bird season's over, Budhorn.
He does. There are a lot of good lines in this movie. Aside from the lines from that stupid, pretentious dog, did not care for him.
Yeah, the dog really. I mean, that's my biggest complaint with this film. If they had cast a more tough breed or like a better voice actor or given him more interesting lines or something.
Mm-hmm.
Because for me, like there's an emotional beat that happens about two-thirds of the way into the movie where he needs to make the decision to leave the dog behind and go to this underground city. And I think that a lot of the third act depends on you really falling for that emotional beat. And it fell flat for me. So I felt like Don Johnson's motivations for the rest of the film were a little bit, you know, hard to root for.
Yeah, I like that scene where they kind of decide. But then after that, like, I didn't care if he got back to the dog or if they met back up or whatever. Like, I like the actual scene where they talk about, hey, you know, maybe we'll meet back up, but I just didn't care once it was over.
But it seems to me like Don Johnson is in the middle of, like, a career comeback right now. He was in Machete a couple years ago, and he's got Django Unchained coming out this month.
Yeah, and he was on Eastbound and Down.
Oh, yeah, that too.
He's back. Also, this dog, you know, he gets injured partway through the movie, and he has to limp for a lot of it. And this was back in 1975, where I bet that they probably just broke this dog's leg to make him limp.
That's what it looked like to me.
Yeah, I don't know how else they could have done it. I mean, and
I think it's either that or they cast two different dogs of the same breed, one that had a broken leg.
Yeah, I thought that could be the case. I thought there was a scene where I saw that, like, maybe they just got a three-legged dog or something, or maybe I just couldn't see his leg.
I think I saw that too, where one of the legs was missing.
Yeah, so they could have done that. So that was, however they got to do it, whether they tortured a dog or not, that was really effective.
So did you guys realize that the dog that they cast in this is the actual dog from the Brady Bunch show, Tiger?
I did not.
That's a true story.
Wow.
Hilarious.
That guy got more post-Brady Bunch work than any of the actual Brady Bunch. That's impressive. There's a scene in this movie, like during this whole movie, I was kind of thinking, until about a half an hour in when they hit this scene, that maybe Don Johnson was just crazy, and that's why he could talk to the dog, is because, not that he was talking to the dog, but he was just talking to himself, you know, and portraying it onto the dog, sort of like in Dexter with Harry or something. And, but then there's this scene where Don Johnson leaves, and then the dog's just kind of hanging out and, reacting to the girl, and then it seems, you know, that that's not the case, that this dog actually can talk. And then I read online, I don't remember this line being in the movie, but apparently they say that it was the result of some experiment that the dog can speak telepathically to only one guy. But I don't know, I think that it would have been more interesting to leave it maybe ambiguous rather than, I mean, I guess it's still pretty ambiguous, I mean, but it seems more like this is actually happening and this dog can actually talk. How did you guys feel about it?
I actually agree with you. I think it would have been better if they had left that scene with Suzanne Benton out of the film. I think they should have kept it ambiguous. It's not clear to me if it's ambiguous in the source material or not, but that would have made for a more interesting film.
Yeah, I think in the source material they go more into it and they say that he
has dolphin spinal fluid.
Yeah, he has like dolphin spinal fluid, so that's why he can talk telepathically.
But I don't know, because that's really the only, you know, surrealistic or non-realistic part of the film is the telepathy with the dog. Everything else is pretty cut and dry.
Yeah, well, and then there are the screamers who are supposed to be like these mutant type of guys. I think when you were talking about them earlier, I think those were two separate dudes, like that gang and then the screamers. I think those are two separate guys. Like, I don't think you ever see the screamers. You just hear them scream a bit. And I think that at least according to Wikipedia, the screamers are like these mutated ghouls that really like Serbian film and necromantic. and they like hang out, you know, in ruins and stuff, and they're ghoulish. And I guess they play a bigger role in the books, but they're not in this. But yeah, I guess, you know, as they're not in this, the dog is really the only, like, surreal, weird thing. And in theory, the screamers are too, but they don't actually show up.
Yeah, I think that part of the film is a little bit muddy in the way that they cut it together. It wasn't too clear to me what was going on in those moments between the porno theater and him deciding to fight that gang.
Yeah, well, it's like so dark that you can barely tell what's going on in that. That's another few scenes that I didn't like. It was just crazy dark.
Yeah, everything before the underground city is poorly lit, and at least on the version I saw, which was via Netflix, it was extremely muddy and hard to make out, unfortunately. I think that this film might actually look really nice if someone were to clean it up and give it a proper re-release.
Yeah, that would be good, because this movie, I think if it looked better, it would look a lot better, because at the risk of sounding redundant, because there's a lot sort of visually that looks pretty good, and I mean, of course, in a very like understated 70s way. Nothing looked good in the 70s, but as far as the 70s go, there are like a lot of cool locations and deserts and, you know, the underground stuff that looked pretty cool. So it would be nice if it looked better. So I think that wraps up A Boy and His Dog. We're going to take another quick break, and we'll be back to talk about The Miracle Mile.
Tired of only hearing your junk food dinner hosts talk to you? You want to start talking to them? Then pick up your Zach Morris-like cellular phone and dial 347-746-JUNK. That's 347-746-5865. Leave us a message about the movies we've talked about. Did we give a good review to a movie you think sucks? Did we take a crap on your favorite movie? Let us know. Or call in to suggest a movie, or tell us why you hate LeBron James. Remember to leave a name and the city you represent when you call. We're very lonely, and rarely hear the voices of other humans.
So dial this number now if you dare. Tell them that he sent you.
Love can sure spin your head around. God, where do you begin?
Well, hello.
We must have been meant to be together.
It's too bad you have to work tonight.
Only till midnight.
Fate is a funny thing.
Take a nap, because you're going to need all your energy tonight.
It was one of those strange nights.
Finally meet the right girl and you blow it.
That could ruin your whole day. In a big way.
Dad, it's happening. This is it. This is really it. This is the big one.
This is a joke, right?
It's really happening.
Happening. Happening.
This can't be true. We'll all be dead if we don't get out of here.
Nobody believes this, do they?
Not me, not Spongy.
Make a list for me. People who we want to bring along.
We gotta get Julie.
Who's Julie?
Harry Belafonte.
Who are you? Who are you?
Stop and let me off.
I don't stop for nothing. Jump!
Don't hurt me, man. I got Nakamichi Pioneer. I got everything.
If it doesn't happen, I'll pay you.
What doesn't happen, man?
I'm dreaming. That's it, I'm dreaming.
Y'all ready to go?
You the pilot?
Hey! Hey, do you know anybody who can fly helicopter?
Helicopter pilots.
all the helicopter pilot bars are closed.
What's the problem?
It's true.
Love can be exciting.
Trust me with this.
Even terrifying.
Julie!
Leave me out! I love you!
But nothing could prepare you for an experience like this.
What is it, Julie?
Miracle Mile.
Listen, I'm just a guy who picked up the phone.
Welcome back to Junk Food Dinner. The next movie we'll be talking about is Miracle Mile from 1988. This is directed by Steve Desjarnat, or maybe Jarnat. I don't know. Maybe he doesn't have to be French. Maybe I don't have to produce it like that. He directed Cherry 2000, which I hear is awesome, and the Lizzie McGuire TV show, and something else that is cool. The X-Files TV show, some episodes of that. Oh, and Strange Brew. That's the other thing. This movie is starring the one guy from Top Gun, Anthony Edwards. He plays a guy named Harry. He works at the La Brea Tar Pits, which this movie made me want to actually go to the La Brea Tar Pits in Los Angeles because it made it look a lot cooler than you would think that a tar pit would be. And he plays, you know, a museum type of guy, a real nerdy guy, a lonely guy. One day, a very ugly girl named Julie comes into his museum, and, you know, he falls in love with her. That, you know, he kind of sees her, and he's like, oh, she's so cute. And then she leaves, and he's like, oh, I blew it. She was so cute. I should have talked to her. And then she's standing outside, and then they talk. Then they go out on basically the longest first date of all time. They pack so much into this one date. They go, he plays a concert because he, like, plays the tuba or the saxophone or something.
Trombone.
You know, she goes to the concert to watch him do this. She brings her grandpa. You know, they're going out to eat. They're doing all this crazy stuff, packing up so much stuff into one day. She has to go to work, though, so their date ends. But she says, hey, after work, meet me here, and we'll go out and we'll, you know, finish this date because we are falling in love in this montage. He says, cool, I'm going to go home, take a nap. I'll be back. It'll be sweet. But there's a fire at his hotel. He's from there's a fire. He wakes up late and misses her. She goes home. She's all upset. She goes home and goes to sleep. He goes back to the restaurant. He hits a tree and rats fall out of it. Which, is this something that happens, Sean Byron? Is that something that you have constant fear of in L.A.?
That is the first time I've ever seen that, but I feel like that was probably the funniest point in the film. I laughed out loud at that scene.
Yeah, I've never seen that here, so I didn't know if that was like an L.A. thing or if that was like a movie thing or what was happening. But I was, if that were the case that happens, I was going to have a whole new fear of this godforsaken desert. So, you know, he's in there and he's all, hey, where did Julie go? And they're like, she left. And he goes outside and he tries to call her, but somebody calls him on the payphone outside. Payphones, for you younger listeners, are things that used to exist. They were kind of like cell phones, but huge and tied to one spot around town. And you would put money into them to use them. Somebody calls him. It's a guy frantic. He's saying, hey, it's the end of the world. You know, they pushed all the buttons. All the nukes are going to fly. And, you know, all our nukes are going to fly. All the Russians' nukes are going to fly. It's the end of the world. And the guy, you know, Anthony Edwards is all, is this a joke? Who is this? Blah, blah, blah. And the guy's like, hey, is this not my dad? Do I have the wrong number? And Anthony Edwards is like, yeah, you got the wrong number. And then there are gunshots. And then the line goes dead. So Anthony Edwards, you know, reasonably freaks out. He goes back into the diner. He's asking around for, you know, who this guy might have been calling, or if anybody knows this guy, or if anybody knows anything about what's happening. And he eventually, you know, cracks in this scene and tells them that the world's about to end, and everybody's yelling at each other. People are freaking out. Some of them think it's a joke, and they kind of dismiss it. Some people are freaking out. Some people, you know, start stockpiling stuff and talking about, we gotta get out of town now. Some people are just like going nuts and getting angry, pulling out guns. Before Twitter, this is how we delivered all news, by the way.
With utter chaos.
Just complete meltdowns.
I heard Michael Jackson died. What do you mean? Oh, I gotta get
table flip.
I gotta get canned goods. stuff like that. So, yeah. So Anthony, you know, they all pile into this van. They're gonna go to the a building because the broad from Star Trek is in the diner, and she seems to be in the know a little bit. She kind of confirms this story that this is possibly the end of the world. And, you know, she gets a helicopter to meet them on a rooftop, and they're all going to get to it and get out of town before the end of the world. Anthony Edwards stays behind because he wants to find this girl, because he wants to be with her if the world's going to end. He wants to take her, you know, with him, everything like this. And so that's basically what happens in this movie. It's the trailer, which I'd never heard of this movie before. I was looking up movies to do for this end of the world theme show. I was thinking about doing The Watchmen because I love it, or Mad Max because I love it. And I looked at a bunch of, you know, best end of the world movies of all time. And this was on like all the lists, and I'd never heard it. And I watched the trailer and I completely wanted to do it, despite a lot of my favorite movies being in this genre, because it looked great. The trailer made this movie look a little bit more like a comedy than it is. It kind of had like a weird tone to the trailer. I don't know. It was kind of weird. But this is basically like a thriller, a drama. There's a few comedic parts in it, kind of. But I mean, it's mostly this guy tracking down this girl, trying to find a way to the rooftop, trying to find a pilot. The pilot they find is the bad guy from Cobra, who was also a vampire on Buffy, I think. And stuff like this. Just a mad dash to kind of get to safety, and, you know, this paranoia and widespread panic that happens that may or may not actually be happening. You know, I mean, it's not revealed till the end whether or not the phone call was real or not. And I think this movie is absolutely great. It takes place mostly in real time, at least the, you know, the parts after the phone call, which I think is outstanding. Anthony Edwards is pretty good in it. They don't spend a lot of time on the characters. I think it would have been cool to get more of them. I didn't really, you know, especially in the beginning during the montage where they're falling in love, like, I didn't really buy that these two people were so madly in love that they had to brave nuclear war to be with each other. But, you know, I don't think the director cared as much about the characters as he did about creating this sort of panic and stuff like that. And that stuff's all perfect. I mean, that stuff's just remarkable in this movie. There are a lot of scenes of, you know, widespread panic in the streets, and then sort of very contained, small panic, like in the diner. You know, the sort of the panic that you would get if you, you know, carjacked a guy and told him the world was going to end, stuff like that. Like, just panic on all these different levels. And I think this movie is great. How do you guys feel about this movie?
I thought this was an amazing movie. I had seen this, I think, as a kid on HBO, and I probably was too young to get some of it. Watching it for the show this week, I was really blown away. I thought it was entertaining throughout. I thought it was, you know, really engrossing. It's, for me, it's a really good sign if I can get through an entire movie without checking where I am in the running time. Mm-hmm. And I'm pretty sure that happened only with this movie this week. It kind of reminded me of a West Coast answer to the Scorsese movie After Hours, where you're following a main character going through these kind of escalating situations throughout the course of one night. And I really like these movies that take place in real time, you know, like Before Sunrise or Adventures in Babysitting, you know, these type of real time movies, I think, really work well in a drama situation like this. The nighttime shots in LA were really beautiful, especially for this kind of a budget. It was relatively low budget for the time. I think it was about $3 or $4 million budget, and those shots looked great. They kind of reminded me of Night of the Comet in a way. I got that kind of a vibe from it. The opening montage I thought was really cool in that natural history museum. It actually almost reminded me of like a Wes Anderson film, the way that they shot it with very perpendicular angles and the camera kind of locked off and panning from side to side. there's some good character actors in here. You got Kurt Fuller, who you would probably recognize immediately from Wayne's World. Mm-hmm. He's kind of amusing in this. You got John Agar, who plays the grandfather. He's a character actor you've probably seen in Nightbreed or The Amazing Mr. No Legs. He's always good as kind of the grandfather or kind of wily old man type character. Kelly Jo Minter shows up. She's in Freddy Part 5, Popcorn, and The Lost Boys. Mm-hmm. She gets like only one line. She's like that dying girlfriend of the car radio thief.
Yeah, I like her a lot. I was sad that she wasn't in it more.
What else was good about this? I really loved all the locations that they shot at here. Any fan of like architecture or anybody who's familiar with like LA history would probably really love this film because they show a lot of great locations, you know, besides the La Brea Tar Pits and Park La Brea and the Santa Monica Pier. They have like Johnny's Coffee Shop where most of the action in the first half of the film takes place. Famously, Reservoir Dogs was filmed there, but a lot of movies have filmed there. But it's been closed for about 10 years, but I think it's still open for filming. And also the Pan Pacific Auditorium made its final film appearance. That's the building that there's a brief scene where they're doing a rally to try and save a building. And that's the Pan Pacific Auditorium. It was featured prominently in Xanadu. But what I thought was amusing is the characters in that scene are trying to save the building. It had famously kind of fallen into disrepair. And unfortunately, in real life, that building burned to the ground 5 days after this movie opened in 1989.
Wow.
So it's kind of a sad end for that building. The characters in the film, their dialogue was clearly written by somebody who's lived in L.A. for quite a while. They all have really good taste in food. Like, they are constantly citing real restaurants that exist in L.A. The grandfather character talks about pastrami sandwiches at Cantor's Deli, which is kind of an LA institution, and the drag queen in the diner is talking about Dr. Hoggly Woggly's Tyler Texas Barbecue, which is a real place with really good barbecue.
Yeah, Adam Carolla talks about that place all the time. I want to go there.
It's pretty good. You should go there. It's in Panorama City, I think. One thing that I found interesting was that without even really looking for it, I noticed that there was a Twilight Zone connection to all three movies that we covered tonight. And with this film, apparently this script was written and at one point was considered for the Twilight Zone movie, but with an altered ending. And I think you can still feel, without giving anything away about the ending, you can feel that there is kind of an openness in the last third of the film where it could go either way. Mm-hmm. And I think it would have been interesting to see what the Twilight Zone version of this movie would have been.
Absolutely.
But we get a different ending that I think is also very interesting, and I'm glad that they went the way that they did. Another interesting fact is there's that riot scene that happens right in front of the coffee shop at Wilshire and Fairfax, where Anthony Edwards is standing on either a car or something. He's elevated above the street, and you can see the widespread panic in the streets. That actually came true 3 years later at that same intersection with the 1992 LA riots. That whole neighborhood got shot up pretty bad. So that's kind of interesting. But yeah, overall, I really love this film. I thought it was gripping throughout. I thought it escalated well. You know, the suspense was always building, and they went some interesting places with it that I didn't expect.
Indeed. How do you feel about the parts of this that you saw, Mr. Frisbee?
Oh, those parts were fantastic. Nice. Yeah, unfortunately, I've only caught maybe like the first 10 minutes. But the film is, for that respect, gorgeous. And the museum montage that we were just talking about, that does remind me a lot of Wes Anderson and has this sort of dreamlike quality to it. I think it actually worked. The cinematography worked, to even though Parker suggested that the lead actress is the ugliest girl in the world. It made the romance between them seem very tangible and believable. So I'm interested to watch the rest of it, most definitely. Also, kind of like Bronx, where it does display some of LA, and I'm anxious to see those nighttime shots that Sean was just talking about, because I find that kind of stuff curious about some of these movies from the 80s where they let the scenery do a lot of the work, and to see what it looked like at that time, pre-riot. One of my other films I actually really like about LA is LA Story, from Steve Martin, and it does that one's more of like a slapsticky look at life on the West Coast, but this one seems more earnest and interesting. And yeah, after Sean's comments, I'm even more interested to see it than what I was.
Yeah. In a way, it kind of reminded me of Falling Down with Michael Douglas, because it's a similar approach where you're going from location to location. And these are pretty recognizable landmarks. I think even people who are not in Los Angeles would recognize a lot of these landmarks. And setting the story in these various locations, I think it automatically adds a sense of production value. And when you're on like a low budget, as I think they were for this film, that's a quick path to a good looking film, is to shoot in a good looking area that people recognize.
Yeah, and I love the way that this was all apparently filmed, you know, like in this small little area, this Miracle Mile area. And I mean, I've only been to LA once, but watching big budget movies and stuff, like you can kind of tell, like, you know, like Chev Chelios will have to go from downtown to Santa Monica to Hollywood to, you know, this place. And it's like, this would take hours and hours and hours. Like, I know you're banking on the fact that most people who watch this movie are from Montana, but, you know, come on. Like, there's no way Chev Chelios is going to all these places. But in this movie, because it's, you know, this small little area, I think it makes it a lot more believable, you know, that all this is happening in real time. Rather than if they were, you know, if they did a shot at the beach where they're hanging out at the beach and then they go to this place and all this.
It also adds kind of a feeling of claustrophobia as well, because that's one of the more built up sections of Los Angeles, where it's a relatively dense area. And by keeping all the action in this one place, you feel trapped there, as the character becomes later on when the rioting starts.
Mm-hmm.
Another interesting factoid I saw on IMDb regarding this movie is that Jack Nance was originally offered the role of the cook in the diner. Jack Nance being the star of Eraserhead, or you may know him from Twin Peaks. But he turned down the role to focus on his day job as a security guard.
Wow.
Just classic Jack Nance.
Yeah, that's wild. They must have not been paying very much at all for this movie.
I guess not.
Yeah. Well, yeah, so this movie rules. So we're going to take another break, and then we'll be back, and then we'll let you know that the nuclear warheads have deployed, and it's up to you to figure out if we're telling the truth or not.
JunkFoodDinner.com is the world's oldest and sexiest website. Go to junkfooddinner.com for the latest episodes of the show. We also have all of our past episodes. You will also find news about the show, movie news, trailers, funny stuff, and links to our friends. You can also leave us log comments, because that makes us happy. We hope our website will be a good way for you to spend time during the downtime in life, when celebrities are not going hilariously crazy, and when the Warcraft servers are down.
Can't do it. We'll do it live. No, we'll do it live. Fuck it. Do it live. I'll write it and we'll do it live. Fucking thing sucks.
Okay, that's about the end of the show. Real quick though, as per the suggestion by a kissing contest producer and occasional Junk Food Dinner listener, Doan, we're gonna do a thing real quick called Face to Face Chat. It's where I talk about this band Face to Face that I like a lot. And, you know, I had the chance to see them in Las Vegas. They were playing an acoustic set, and I didn't go because I wanted to walk around the casinos and gamble and do all that stuff. And I really regret it. It's a real big bummer because they're a sweet band. So that's Face to Face Chat. Hopefully it'll become a recurring segment on the show. So that's the end. I'd like to thank Sean Byron for joining us. It's a real treat to have you on. You're very nice, and you help us out a lot, and you suggest a lot of movies that we still haven't done for the most part.
Well, thank you for having me. It's been a lot of fun. And, yeah.
And also thank you, Jason Razor Babes Frizzbabe. You helped out on very short notice when it was announced that Mark was murdered and set on fire.
Those are two really awful things on a birthday, but yeah, maybe I could help. That's great.
Yeah, thanks. You can find Jason Frisbee on his podcast called Pool Party Radio every week at poolpartyradio.com and on iTunes. So there's that. You can also find him on Twitter at Jason Frisbee. Would you like to plug anything, Sean Byron?
The only thing that comes to mind is I have a Tumblr site called catscares.tumblr.com where I cut out the various cat scares from horror films and post them to YouTube.
Oftentimes the best part of a horror film, so it's good to have those.
Yeah.
Also, I was on Rotten Rantings this week. It will come out next week, I guess, though. Katie Ratz was on this show for a couple of weeks ago to talk about werewolves and stuff. She's the host of that show. She invited me on. Well, she invited all of us on, but Kevin's in Boston and Mark is dead. Nah, JK, he's not dead. He'll be back. And so, yeah, so I was on that show. We're talking about Idle Hands and Snakes on a Plane. Spoiler alert, it sucks. And Tucker and Dale vs. Evil. So you can find that at RottenRantings.com or on iTunes. Also, check out Hide the Bodies, because they make shirts that you can buy or get your own shirts made or whatever it is. That's at HTBKicksAss.com. You know, I don't want to screw the pooch in case this doesn't happen, but there's rumors there might be a junk food dinner shirt in the future, so keep your eyes peeled. As for us, you can check us out on junkfooddinner.com. You can find all our episodes there. You can find nerd news, links to our friends, all kinds of stuff like that. There's also a huge list of every movie we've ever talked about on the show and what episode they're on. So if you know, you just want to do a quick search for your favorite movie and find it, it's there. We're also on iTunes. If you would like to leave us a review or a rating, that would be awesome. It would help people find us. And we will love you forever. You can email us at jfdpodcast@gmail.com. That would be awesome. We'll read it. We'll have a lot of fun with that. We like getting those. Those are the nutrients that keep us alive, those in the iTunes things. We're also at facebook.com/junkfooddinner, junkfooddinner.tumblr.com, Twitter, @junkfooddinner. We're everywhere you want to be. So next week, we have our Christmas-themed show. We're going to be doing Mark's movie that I forget the name of, that's very old. We're going to be doing Babes in Toyland, and we're going to be doing Saint.
Does Kevin make an appearance?
Yes, Kevin will be back. He will be back. Also, Mark will be back. So it's going to be a good one. So this is Parker, Jason, and Sean Byron, and Kevin Moss, and Mark Fredo Jr. saying, fuck you, Chelios.